Okay, guys, thank you so much for coming. We'll just take a couple of minutes. Krex is really happy to introduce you, Matt Watson, today, which most of you probably know already. He was the PACE, he's the PACE responsible for the REF assessment program in the UK. He has published on a lot of different journals, a variety of different topics. He's going to get us through the process of peer reviewing. He's going to tell us a little bit how things work and demystify some of the fears around it. And you can be in better hands for someone to explain you that, and on that note, I'll leave you to it.
Thanks, Lorenzo. Hello, everyone. I guess I sit here with many hats on at the same time. The peer review process is something that I experience in many different ways. As author, as reviewer, as PhD supervisor, I experience it once again through your eyes, or through the eyes of my PhD students anyway, as early career mentor as well. The suggestion for this session, I think, came from Lisa and Lorenzo, and it covers up a bit of an oversight that I've sat in front of different groups of CRIP students for years and years, talking to them about the significance of the publishing process, and I've never got round to telling you about the ins and outs of what happens when you submit your work to peer review, because there are lots of things that I imagine, if you're not at that stage yet, will strike you as being particularly odd the first time that you experience them. And so what more helpful way than getting somebody who knows all about it just to tell you what you're likely to expect. So apologies, because I think it probably is my fault personally that we've never had a session like this before, because we've had plenty of sessions where I've sat here and said that the easiest way of making quick strides on the academic jobs ladder is to publish. And yet, of course, there are some nuts and bolts of the publishing process, including submitting your work to journals for peer review, that nobody has ever thought to come and sit and talk to you about. So apologies for that. And after the apologies out of the way, let me confront the most obvious elephant in the room straight away. And that's the fact that the peer review process does not run smoothly for everyone. In fact, any academic that you could point to will have some sort of experience of having found the peer review process really rather brutal in the past. There is no escaping this, I'm afraid, other than to say that it does happen to everyone, and it happens to everyone really rather regularly. On Sunday, I received a rejection letter, came through my email. Probably shouldn't have been working on a Sunday, but there I was, waiting for it to come in. And there it was, telling me that all my hard work over three lots of revisions had come to nothing, and that the journal weren't going to accept it anyway. So it happens. I think one of the particularly distressing things, though, when you're going through this for the first time or the first couple of times, is that it seems to mean more to you in terms of your career planning at that stage. There is a luxury of seniority in this respect. It doesn't really matter to my research CV that I've now only got 37 published articles on it and not 38 because of Sunday's rejection letter. It doesn't really make a huge amount of difference. If people are going to phone me up to try to poach me away from Warwick, they're going to phone me up anyway. It becomes much more acutely important when you're first making your way onto the academic jobs ladder, though. Because the difference between having no pieces of work published in a peer-reviewed journal and one piece of work published in a peer-reviewed journal is massive. The difference, again, between having one piece and two pieces is massive. The difference between 37 and 38 pieces, who cares? It really doesn't matter at all in that respect. So there is something, I think, particularly acute about learning how to cope with lots of the unfortunate sides of the peer review process when you're at that stage of your career, as you all are, where it really, really does matter, where it matters more than it's ever going to matter again. Now, one of the coping strategies that some more established academics have is that they try to take the sting out of it by sitting around in groups and telling one another self-deprecating stories about the worst review that they've ever had. And I think this is the luxury of seniority, because you get to the stage where you can just turn around and laugh at these things. You can laugh at how ridiculous they are. So let me try to tell you what people like me would end up doing if we were having some sort of therapy session about the peer review process, by telling you some of the oddest outcomes of peer review that I've come across in my career. Not all of these are about me, and so maybe I will have to turn the recording off for a minute. So just for the sake of the people who are listening to the recording rather than being in the room, I'm now going to give everyone a series of real reviews that other people that I know have experienced in the past, just to show you, one, how brutal they can be, but two, how frankly ridiculous they can be at the same time. Oh, yeah, pressing harder did the trick. There you go. Back to normal now. So if there's anything, I guess if there's an underlying message to come out of this sort of review, is that if at all possible, don't take it too personally. I fear I'm on a bit of a hiding to nothing saying that to you. How can you possibly open up an email that contains this sort of treatment and not take it personally? And obviously it's much more important when you're just starting out in the early stages of your career, and you're much more likely to try to take things to heart. They probably can't be laughed off in the same way that more senior academics can laugh them off. But please don't allow it to really dissolve the whole of your academic world. I know how dispiriting it is the first time that you receive a rejection letter. I know the sorts of thoughts that go through your mind, because there would have been the same sorts of thoughts that were going through my mind when I was in your position. You begin to question whether you're up to it, whether all of your dreams of an academic career are built on sand. You begin to doubt your own PhD, even whether the PhD is going to be deemed worthy by the examiners if this is the treatment that you get out of the peer review process. Hopefully, however, you'll be able to learn relatively quickly not to take it in that way. One of the things that all academics have to get used to, this isn't a very pleasant story to have to tell, is that you get told no a lot more often than you get told yes. When it comes to submitting any piece of work to a journal, you're much more likely for that piece of work to be rejected by that journal than you are for it to be accepted. The same is absolutely true of grant applications as well. Most of the grant schemes which we're required to spend a large proportion of our time applying for money from have success rates of less than 10%. So this isn't a comment on you if you get told no. This is about the law of probability. If the acceptance rate on a journal is well down below 20%, then we know what that means, that only one in five articles that's submitted there is ever going to see the light of day in the pages of that journal. And this is one of the significant ways in which the job has changed and the job has got more difficult over the time that I've been doing it. When I first started, so when I finished my PhD back in the last century, just it wasn't unusual for even relatively decent journals to have something like a 40% success rate. So, okay, 40%, the odds are still against you. There are going to be more rejection letters than acceptance letters sent out, even if the acceptance rate is as high as 40%. Lots and lots of journals these days have acceptance rates of no more than 10%. For good tier one journals, acceptance rates are always going to be 20% or lower. So it's a real struggle to be able to get pieces of work published in those sorts of journals. And it also raises issues about strategy that we might talk about as well. So do you go for your first choice journal first with a particular piece of work? Or do you assume that this is going to be a scoping exercise where you're hoping to see how it gets on in the review process, hoping to be told by the reviewers, in fingers crossed, quite a nice way, how the article might be tightened up, with a view then to sending it to your first choice journal second? And I don't know what the answer to that is. Sometimes that seems to work as a strategy, sometimes it doesn't. But I guess the first major message to send you is that journals are massively, massively, massively oversubscribed. There are just more people trying to write academic articles and more people writing better academic articles now than there ever have been. And so the squeeze for the space in journals is much more significant than it ever has been. But this still doesn't get round the really rather odd fact that it seems to be that a lot of reviewers take it upon themselves almost to go out of their way to be deliberately antagonistic, that some of the reviews that come back really are not helpful at all. I'm not sure anybody should feel too upset if they get a rejection letter, but that's accompanied by a series of helpful points from reviewers as to how the article might be reworked. Because it's often the case that other people see more in our work than we do ourselves. Sometimes you have to expose it to public scrutiny for you to be able to really get to grips with what you've got within your own argument. This happens all the time for me. I'm more than happy to think that my work is not going to get in the first time around because I'm going to get some good advice from journal referees. But what about the ones that really don't operate in that way? Why might reviewers be quite so mean in some situations? Well, I've got a few answers. I'm not sure any of them are good ones, and certainly none of them are an excuse, but they might be answers nonetheless. One is just the overload of work. That it's possible to get asked to do lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of reviews. I think I probably field somewhere around 25 requests to review articles every year. And I try to say yes to all of them if I can, because I know that it's only through that cycle of people giving their time to the review process that the review process works in any way whatsoever. But also, there's no chance at all that any of this work fits into my officially allocated work hours. So it is always done either very late at night or at the weekend. So it's always done in time where legitimately you could turn around and say, actually, this isn't work time, this is my own time. So it could be that that leads to a degree of grumpiness amongst reviewers. Again, I stress I don't think that that's an excuse at all. I think that reviewers should always be able to think what it would be like to open up their review and to read it as a comment on their work. And if they were to put themselves in that position and to ask themselves what they would be happy reading as a review on their own work, then that might change the culture of the way in which reviews are undertaken. It might also be the case that some people get carried away with the power that anonymous peer review delivers. I really do get the sense that a lot of people say things behind the veil of anonymity that they wouldn't say to somebody's face. And when you begin doing reviews for yourself, I think this is a nice standard to adopt. Obviously the opposite of that one. So only say things through anonymous peer review that you would happily say to somebody's face. A third possible reasons. I think I've come across quite a few, not necessarily on my work, but certainly on the work of my PhD students that they've shown me, where somebody, let's face it, it's just the academic ego that comes into play. That you've touched a raw nerve with the reviewer. They probably think, bizarrely, that they're the only person worthy enough to be able to comment authoritatively on this topic, and therefore they don't want some upstart muscling in on their territory, and the best way to deal with them is just to get rid of them. Horrible, horrible, horrible if that happens, but I think that it does. I've even come across people reflecting out loud that there are strategic decisions at play when you're invited to review an article, that if you find somebody writing in an area that's too much of an overlap with yours, then the best thing to do is to try to get it rejected, because obviously the fewer pieces of work like that that are out there in the journals, the more space there is for you to be able to populate the journals with your own work at a later point of time. I just think that's awful. But I also do detect that it goes on. However, sometimes there's just genuine disagreement about what is intellectually important in a particular issue. Let me tell you another very brief story, an experience of mine. I will try not to give away any clues as to whose work this is, but I was asked to review a piece of work a couple of years ago that I thought had the potential to be very, very interesting, but had set the question up in completely the wrong way, that was asking a series of issues about modern life that we see normatively replayed in some of the political agendas in this country, but which I think are normatively indefensible, and certainly needed some sort of defence to be written into them rather than just stating them as fact. And this article was eventually published in the PSA's lead journal and also won the best prize of that year. And this surprised me because I thought that there were fundamental flaws on that. But this morning on the train, thinking these things through, I actually felt just a little tinge of pride that I'd still acted responsibly as the reviewer, because I wasn't willing to say, on the basis of that intellectual disagreement, no, 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 under no circumstances can this ever be published, which is what a lot of other people would do, I think. I allowed my concerns to be known, but I left it in the hands of the editors as to whether they thought that those concerns were of sufficient magnitude to keep the article out of the journal. They clearly disagreed with me, and they then awarded that article the prize for the best article of the year in their journal. So they clearly disagreed with me very strongly. So looking back, I'm now pleased that I didn't do anything to preemptively knock that article on the head, even though I still do think that it remains deeply flawed, both analytically and normatively. And of course, not all reviewers are mean, but it's the rogue reviewers that will always stick out in your mind. For those of you that I taught the first year PhD training module to, which isn't very many anymore, now I look around the room, our first session was on the PhD Viver. And the first thing I said there was that lots of people have very good experiences of the PhD Viver, and there's probably only about 1 in 20 where it all goes a bit hair-raising. But it's the experience of the 1 in 20 that you remember when you're preparing for your own Viver. It's the thought that that could happen to you that dominates that preparation stage. So most PhD Vivers at Warwick go entirely smoothly. It's only the odd one that doesn't. But because you know that the odd one doesn't, it's always that that sticks in your mind. And I think exactly the same principle applies when it comes to a rogue reviewer. Most people are reasonable. They want to write things that are appropriate. They do think that it's part of a disciplinary responsibility to help the profession by providing insight onto the work that peers are writing. And therefore, they take their own duties as a peer reviewer as seriously as they're able to. But it's still the rogue reviewers, the people that have said things that aren't very pleasant to you, that are likely to stick in your mind. I'm afraid that's just how it is, really. Anyway, if those are the pitfalls, let me just tell you one or two things about the way in which you get to that peer review stage in the first place. And also some insights into how the culture of peer reviewing and decision making by journals is changing. I think I've listed 10 things here. Let's see how far I get with them, because it might be that I forget most of them. Firstly, almost all journal submissions now are undertaken electronically, most through the Scholar One website. Most journals now have an active Scholar One website, so everything is submitted electronically. Have any of you seen this sort of thing? You know what you do now? Because it's very different to when I was your age. When I was your age, you had to send off fully double space, typed out, photocopied A4 sheets, one copy for each of three reviewers, one copy for the editors, and one copy for the journal office. So you'd be sending things about this thick through the post. When I was at Birmingham at the start of my career, we had a journal that was being edited within the department. We all had little pigeonholes like that for all of our mail. In the days where people still sent each other memos, so pigeonholes were important. There wasn't email or anything like that. The journal had a whole box that was about that wide and that deep for all the things that would come in for it. So thankfully that's changed. But it also means that it's changed in the way that reviewers are selected. that in the old days it was up to the editors, and the editors would, I think, often have a feel, and maybe a feel for the type of person who might be naturally sympathetic to the sort of work that they were seeing in front of them. And I think there was an implicit agreement amongst journal editors that they would try to do the right thing by their authors, that if at all possible, they would rather sympathetic reviews were delivered rather than unsympathetic ones. Nowadays, it all takes place electronically. Whenever you sign yourself up for a Scholar One account with any journal, whether that's as an author or as a reviewer, so probably some of you already have those with particular journals as reviewers. Everybody's looking blank at me, so I'll take that as a no. But anyway, when this does happen to you, you will be asked as a reviewer for a number of keywords for how you describe your own research. And on the Scholar One submissions as an author, you're also invited to add a number of keywords that help to describe the main arguments that are there in your paper. And guess what? They just try to match these. So they match them electronically. There's no thought that goes in to the type of person, the type of scholar that they are, whether they might be sympathetic or not. So it all becomes depersonalised. And maybe part of the depersonalization process helps to explain, at least to a degree, how some people do hide behind the anonymity of the whole process. I think, anyway. Now, different journals use different numbers of reviewers, 2, 3, 4, possibly, but they do tend to use them in different ways now to how they used to do. Back in the old days, it was quite frequent when an additional review was brought in to break the tie. So if there were two reviews on an article, one said yes, one said no, they would go to a third referee, and that referee really had the power of the tiebreaker in their hand. Did they think it was good enough or not? I even remember having been contacted by editors saying, look, I wonder whether you could do us a favour. We've got a bit of a problem. We sent it out to two referees. They were split. We sent it out to a tiebreaker. They sat on the fence. We just need somebody to make a final decision on this. Please, 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 can you tell us what you think? But can you tell us what you think in a way that leads to a final decision? And that's slightly odd when you're contacted like that, because it does make you feel that actually, all the rest of the peer review process has been slightly in vain up to now, because all the power of decision is in your hands and your hands alone. So that could be a difficult position to be put in. But that never happens these days. And it never happens because in editors' minds, there's no such thing as a tie anymore. If you have three reviews and two of them say no and one of them says yes, then the decision from the editors will always be no. On the other hand, if you have three reviews and two of them say yes and one of them says no, the final decision by the editors will again also always be no. One negative review within three, possibly even one negative review amongst four, is all that's needed for a piece of work to fall at that hurdle. The rejection letter I had on Sunday, it was a piece that had been reviewed in three different stages, four times over, so four referees, three stages, so 12 reviews. Three of the referees had been happy from right at the start, and one of them had been unhappy all the way through. And I wasn't able to do anything to satisfy the unhappy one, so the editors on Sunday said, we've got to stop this now because it could go on forever. So the answer's no. So there isn't any such thing as a tiebreak anymore. There isn't a simple majority decision that's playing. And one of the reasons for this is how oversubscribed journals are. If you can only accept 1 in 10, because you've only got space, I don't know, on a year for 30 articles in your journal, but you're having 300 people submitting articles, then as editors, the new culture now is to look for any reason whatsoever to send a rejection letter out. So any reason whatsoever to say no. So any doubts amongst the referees at any stage in the review process, is usually enough to put paid to your chances now. And it didn't used to be like that. This sounds as though it puts lots of power into the hands of editors, and I'm often asked whether editors just make their own decisions. They disregard the review process. Do they just do favours to their mates? And I think the answer is less so now than they used to. The editors used to exercise much more discretion than they do now. I think now it's just this standard, centralised, automated review system where they look for any excuse possible to get articles out of the system, and that everything runs almost like clockwork in that way. I remember times when good journals, editors of good journals, would get on the phone to me and say, got a bit of a problem, we're a bit short of copy for the next issue of our journal. We know you're always working on something. Have you got something that's nearly written up that you could finish off quickly and then we could send it out to review? That's unthinkable that those sorts of requests could be made these days. And I don't necessarily think that it's a bad thing that editors have less discretion than they used to, because it's certainly the case that journals can't get captured as old boys' networks like they used to in the past. But there are a couple of areas where editors still do have discretion, which I think have been unhelpful. One is that they still get to set the review strategy. And I think this is changing. There's a culture amongst editors which suggests that this is changing as well. I really do detect when I was starting out in the job that there was a real wish to find sympathetic reviewers. I now know more journal editors who go out of their way to try to find what they think are going to be unsympathetic reviewers. That they will say that most you should be allowed to have one person who they think just might be sympathetic to this. That they need to find people. This is the test of rigour. Can you convince somebody who they think would be predisposed to be unsympathetic? But it's nothing of the sort. It doesn't produce more rigorous research at all. It just produces researchers that are scared to put their neck on the line, scared to make an argument, because they've got to somehow appeal to that mushy middle where nobody actually sits. So I think that's been an entirely bad thing where editors have exercised discretion along those lines. The other way in which they exercise discretion is to get rid of articles even before they get sent out to review. The fabled desk rejection. And if you're looking for somebody who's probably had more desk rejections than the whole of the rest of the PACE department put together, then hello, here I am. Because I'm always being told with my work that it just doesn't fit. I take this as a compliment that I'm doing something that other people find difficult to pigeonhole. But maybe I'm lucky again. I've got security of tenure. I'm reasonably safe and secure in my job. So I don't have to be particularly worried about this sort of thing. I have a game going on with one of the leading journals in my sort of area. They keep disputing that it's my area, but my sort of area. And it's one of the best sorts of games that you get to make the rules and only you know that you're actually playing the game. It's brilliant because you can never lose. So that's the sort of game that you want to set up. And my game is that every time I write something, I send it to them knowing that they're going to say, you think this is IPE? This isn't IPE. Get away with you. We're not sending this out to review. And then I wait to see how long it's going to be before they send me a request to referee one of the pieces of work that they do believe is IPE. And at the moment, I've compressed that down. My record is 2 days. 2 days between being told that I don't do IPE to being told that I'm the perfect person from the IPE community to review a piece of work that is IPE. The fourth thing that I was going to say is that now we move into a much more standard process across all journals and a standard process across all types of journal issue. I think it's taken the distinctiveness away from journal special issues. Some of you might already have been involved in things of this nature. And what you will find increasingly is that articles that are written for a journal special issue are put out to exactly the same sort of refereeing process as articles that are just submitted as standalone pieces. Even though that to really work, an article that's published for in a special issue has to talk to the themes of the special issue in a way that it probably wouldn't do otherwise, this isn't taken into account at all, and it's treated just like any other standalone article. So I think that some of the good things about journal special issues have been taken away because of this. Fifthly, I should talk to you about the decisions that are available to reviewers. In general now, these reduce just to three: accept, revise and resubmit, or reject. The number of articles that are accepted as they are, without the need for any revisions at all, are so minuscule that we should probably assume that they're pretty much zero. So therefore, in effect, referees are left with two decisions. They either ask you to revise it along the lines that they suggest and resubmit it, and there's no guarantee that it will be accepted at that point either, or they reject it outright. When I started off, there were a number of intermediate decisions, accept with a certain degree of revisions. So accept with minor revisions, accept with major revisions, but they were still accept. So as long as you did what you were asked to do, you knew that they were going to appear in the journal. Those intermediate decisions have been largely removed now. So pretty much you're working in that first iteration, that first submission, with the two decisions, possible decisions that are left standing, of revise and resubmit or reject. Now, obviously, everyone wants to avoid the reject, so I think this does have an impact on the way that you interpret the decision. I'm now delighted every time I submit a new piece to a journal and I'm kept in the game, that I'm allowed a resubmission. I treat this as success. I'm delighted. I think this is wonderful, because it's far better than the alternative, and the alternative is to be told to sling your hook straight away. But these things have changed as well. I can tell a story of a PhD student that I knew when I was a member of staff at Birmingham, and on two different occasions, during his PhD, he had a decision of accept with minor revisions from very good journals, and he just shrugged his shoulders and said, well, if they don't think it's good enough like that, I'm not doing anything else on it. Never bothered doing the revisions. Would have taken him maybe 2 days of work tops. And it was an accept on that basis. Didn't bother doing it. So a different mentality altogether. I could not believe that anybody today who was told that they got 2 days worth of revisions to get an article in a leading journal and that it would definitely appear would do anything other than cartwheel all the way down Library Road. Because the game has changed to such a degree that that is an unbelievably outstanding success. But 20 years ago, it could be... Nearly 20 years ago, it could be treated... Yeah, I'm not that old. Nearly 20 years ago, it could be... Although I feel it most of the time. Nearly 20 years ago, it could be treated as... Yeah, can't really be bothered to do those. No, I'll just send you somewhere else instead. My eighth point, I think, is that it's always a tricky issue of knowing how much to cede to the wishes of reviewers. So if the reviewers say, I think there's 10 things wrong with them, here are the 10 things... Do you rewrite the whole of the article so those 10 things are made to disappear? How much territory do you cede to them? How much do you give way? How much of your own argument will you be happy to allow disappear if you think that this is what's necessary to satisfy the reviewers? And that's a really tough decision, because you'll have invested a lot of time in writing this article, so you don't want to lose the integrity of your own argument. But you've also invested a lot of psychological energy in thinking about what it might mean to get this journal article published in this particular journal. So you might not want to also give up on the possibility that that might be the case. And I don't think I've got any really great advice for you in that respect. I really don't think there's a hard and fast rule, but you do want the final argument to still represent what it is that you think and what it is that you stand for as an academic. So there must be some lines beyond which you refuse to go. Where those are and how important they are to you, I don't know. Again, I'm in a lucky position now that these extra articles on my CV, they don't make that much difference on a value-added basis. So I can turn around and go, if people are telling me to do too much to my own argument or more to my own argument than I'm prepared to do. But maybe that, again, just goes to show that I'm in a different position to you. And the final thing that I want to say, sorry, I've banged on quite a lot, haven't I? Is that fingers crossed, that whatever your experience of the review process, and I've probably not painted it in a very good light, have I? Whatever your experience of the review process, however bruising it becomes, hopefully it will still give you a way of sharpening the arguments that you have, and give you further insights into what it is about your own argument that you need to present slightly differently to meet the demands of reviewers. And hopefully it also means that it will then help you to get it published elsewhere. In our department, amongst the academic members of staff, there's just a culture of recycling. Almost no article that's published by any one of our members of staff gets accepted straight away. It will have been through sometimes a really, really, really tortuous review process. Sometimes a process that's so tortuous that it will have entailed 3, maybe 4 journals before it finally gets published. I once walked down the old departmental corridors and I heard Nick and John having a conversation, Nick Vaughan-Williams and John Parkinson. So they were just opposite each other in the old corridor. And they were talking about their respective Marmite papers. That's what they were calling them. Because they both had a paper that had been sent to now 3, possibly 4 journals, where on each occasion, one of the reviewers had loved it and one of the reviewers had hated it. And what they had to do was just keep going and keep going and keep going until they found a review process that would enable them to get it published. Because when you have a paper like that and the referees are so split that there isn't any compromise position that you could deliver a rewritten article towards, you just have to go with your instincts. And so if I leave you with one piece of news, in preparation for today, I've done some research of my own. I knocked on a few colleagues' doors and I've spoken to 10 colleagues about the journal articles that appeared in their Ref 2014 submission. And over 3/4 of those articles were rejected by the first journal that they sent it to. Not a single one of them. And these were the best articles that were published by PACE colleagues during the last ref period. Not a single one of them was accepted as it was in the first instance. Everything had at least a revise and resubmit, possibly 2 revisions and resubmissions. And 75% of them were rejected the first time around. Bizarrely, I tried to finish on that because I thought that might be good news. But maybe I've misjudged the room completely. But merely to say that if you are sitting there and you've already had a bad experience, please, please, please don't think that you're alone. Please don't think that you're the only person who's had a negative review and that negative review has led to the demise of that particular journal article. It really does happen to all of us, and it happens to all of us all of the time. There are some of us that are in a better position just to be able to shake this off and to laugh this off, because it really doesn't matter all that much to us. But hopefully that's what you're looking forward to in the next few years as you begin to successfully navigate your way around the peer review process. I still tried to finish on a crescendo there, Lorenzo, and I failed again. I'm not going to try for a third time because we could be here all night with me just digging a bigger hole for myself. So why don't I end there and take questions? Please just let me know. And I'll turn this off, the questions, so you can say whatever you like without worrying that you're going to be